Good evening, everybody. I'd like to welcome you to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is David, and I'm an alcoholic. For those who care to join, let's open the meeting with a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Seriously, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask those present, please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. The AA preamble states, Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open Big Book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight, which tonight we'll be talking about step three. Please welcome our panel. We have Heidi and Melissa. So, let me on the right page. Step three said, did you guys decide who was going first?
Yeah, Reed, we'll figure it out.
Yep.
We got it.
Got a couple seconds, right?
It's like a well-oiled machine up here.
It's going to work wonderfully.
God's got it.
That's what you get when you give an alcoholic a choice. Step three, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood it. Our first paragraph tonight starts on page 60. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought.
Sure.
Hi, I'm Heidi. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Heidi.
Hey, everybody. Now, thanks for having me. It's wonderful to be here. And it's fun to be sharing the stage with Melissa, who I just met, but who has like all sorts of writing all over her book, just like I do. So we're already matching, which I think is just totally cool. So the reading that we just had, you know, that A, B, and C component, you know, I was taught that's I can't, he can, I think I'll let him. You know, going with a, you know, realization of kind of doing, you know, steps one, two, and leading into three. You know, so step one being, you know, I admitted I was an alcoholic, that my life had become unmanageable. You know, honestly, that one took a really long time for me. I mean, I grew up in a household where my mom was in Al-Anon since the age, you know, I was like 3 years old. You know, so I grew up around steps, which was really cool for me, I think, you know, in the long run, you know, and my mom was good Al-Anon. She actually did not try to stop me from drinking, and she let me just take my course and have my own bottom, which I guess was probably cool, you know, but like the last 7 years of my drinking, I knew I was an alcoholic. I just didn't think it was a big deal, and I didn't think it was hurting anyone. You know, I, by that time, you know, I had made it through college. I was in grad school. Like, things on the, I had two cars in the garage. You know, I didn't have the white picket fence, but, like, the house was that kind of thing. You know, I was married, so I was like, eh, you know, I everything I put my mind to, I can do. You know, and in a lot of things, that was true. I somehow gave myself excuses for the fact that I had cheated on any boyfriend I'd ever had, like, ever, you know, and every time I drew a line in the sand, I crossed it, you know, so, like, when I was like, oh, okay, so I've cheated on every guy I've dated, like, so what, you know, I mean, I'm just having fun, you know, and then when I got engaged, I'm like, I'm sure I won't do it now, and then opportunities arose, and, you know, I mean, I just make friends when I drink, so I'm a friendly person, what can I say, you know, and then I was just like, okay, well, it's because I'm just engaged, you know, I mean, no big deal, right, you know, and then we got married, and somehow, yeah, there was, like, stress at work, and someone else was stressed, and hey, let's de-stress each other. You know, I mean, like, I ended up, you know, it's kind of like I'd put a drink in me and my clothes would fall off kind of thing. So it was, you know, but that didn't seem to be a problem because, like, my husband is still there. So, you know, I mean, hey, how bad can it be? You know, eventually, though, that did, I think I had an episode where, you know, maybe going off topic, you know, an episode where it was one wild and crazy, because those are the fun kind of nights, right? You know, so it was a wild and crazy New Year's Eve. And, you know, I ended up coming to, because I had a habit of blacking out all the time, you know, but my body kept going. So it was like having all sorts of fun, like, and I'd come to in the middle of things, you know, but when I came to, I woke up, I, you know, realized that there was a gun sitting on the table, the nightstand next to me, and some dude who I didn't know, which that was not an unusual thing. The gun freaked me out. I'm just like, ooh, this, wow, how did, wow, where am I, and how did I end up here, and what else is in this house? You know, but I kept drinking for like 6 more years, I think, after that. But, you know, so I had some aha moments. At any rate, you know, so I finally admitted I was an alcoholic, that my life had become unmanageable. You know, luckily, because I grew up with Al-Anon thing, and I grew up with hippy-dippy parents who did all, like, Buddhist, pagan, Wiccan kind of stuff, you know, I knew there was something out there in the universe, so that part, that no human power could relieve our alcoholism, and the follow-on that something else could, like, I was actually okay with that. The I'm not in control, and I have to let someone else do it, that took a while, and that's the rest of this talk, so I'll stop now.
Thanks, my name's Melissa. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Melissa.
My sobriety date is September 8th, 2014. I have a sponsor. She is aware that she sponsors me. and I do take other people on this program through the steps. A lot of what Heidi said, same thing, the ABCs. It took me a while to get to this point. When I came into the rooms for real, my first experience in AA was via a treatment center. I stuck around for about a month, read the steps on the wall, worked the ones that pertained to me, with myself, no sponsor, and I was good. I had this, and I stayed dry for about 6 months, and then life started happening, broke up with a boyfriend, and I didn't know what to do with those feelings. So I drank. That's all. That was my solution to life. If I didn't know what to do, let me just numb it out. And it took me about 3 months of crossing even more lines in the sand, like Heidi talked about, to finally admit defeat and surrender fully at the time, fully what I thought was fully surrendering to the program. And I got the I'm powerless. The unmanageability thing took me a while. I'd been with the same employer for about 14 years. I'd never been evicted, never, you know, lost a job, lost a car, lost a house, anything like that. I'd never been arrested. I've never had a DUI. Like, on paper, I look perfect. Inside, I was a dead, empty shell of a human being, and I didn't know what to do about that. And, you know, when I finally came back in, I'd heard all these little slogans, meeting makers make it, 90 and 90, do this, that, and the third. Well, I'm an overachiever. I graduated from rehab in 18 days. They told me I was cured and I could go home, so I already had that checked off my list. So I'm going to do 90 in like 30, right? My days off of work, I'd go to 5 or 6 meetings. I'd start at the oceanfront at like 8 o'clock and just work my way back to Norfolk. Because we're incredibly blessed in this area. We have so many meetings to choose from, sometimes too many, I think, because I like to use that as an excuse to go hide. Anyway, that's an outside issue. But, you know, so I'm going to a ton of meetings, and I would tell you I was going to a ton of meetings. I was very proud of that fact. And I was doing a lot of fellowshipping. So I would go early, I would stay late, I would go eat after a meeting, I'd hang out. Didn't have that sponsor. I had a sponsor in name, someone who I said was my sponsor because I saw her 4 times a week at my home group. But I never once in 5 months called this woman. And at 5 months, I was at work one Saturday night. Nothing had happened, good, bad, or indifferent. And just the thought popped into my mind, where can I stop on the way home and get a glass of wine? Just one. And it scared me enough. I thankfully early on had hooked up with 2 women in the program, one who had 6 months and one who had like 30 some years. I didn't get that because I was 33 at the time and I was like, she's been sober almost as long as I've been alive. How's that possible? But 6 months I could get. I could wrap my head around, you know, maybe somebody could do it for that long. And they just basically loved me and told me to get in the car and go. And I did that. As part of my little 90 and 30. And I called one of those women, and I was like, it's 8:30, it's a Saturday night, and I don't want to drink, but the thought popped into my head. And then I wanted to drink as soon as the thought popped in my head, because then that obsession got activated, and my brain wouldn't shut off, and I didn't know what to do about that. And for the first time in my life, instead of taking that drink, I called somebody and I was like, I don't know what to do about this. And that, those 3 words, I don't know, do not exist in my vocabulary. They do today, but they did not used to exist in my vocabulary. So she was like, there's a meeting at 9:30. It's right around the corner from where you work. You get off work at 9, just go over there. And I was like, okay. So I went over there and I got there and I sat in this parking lot till 9:25 and no one was showing up to open this meeting. And this meeting is in a strip mall, and there's a bar, and there's the meeting. And if you're from Virginia Beach, you know what meeting I'm probably talking about. And I am sitting in my car on the phone, like, in hysterics. Like, how can they do this to me? Don't they know I need a meeting? Don't they know I'm about to drink? How is someone not showing up to open it? Because it's all about me, right? And she's like, there's a new meeting that just started. Why don't you go across town? It starts at 10. I was like, okay. So headed across town. And I honestly don't remember what the topic was in that meeting. They had a gong. I was like, this is kind of weird. But someone shared in that meeting about how, you know, they kept things inside and they drank again. And, you know, they weren't doing everything that the program suggested. And, like, I'd been sitting in a shitload of meetings for 5 months and apparently had never heard that. Maybe I should, you know, get a sponsor and work the steps. I absolutely had, because this friend that I was on the phone with had been gently suggesting sponsors to me for about 2 months. And I finally took one of those suggestions like 3 days later and asked someone to sponsor me. And got busy in the steps and got, you know, to this point. But, you know, my experience was not, let me come in and I'm going to start right away. My experience was, let me come in. Let me see what this is about. Let me identify a little bit with you guys, hang out for a little bit and see how this goes. And then if I'm really that bad, I'll maybe do this. You know, my experience is what it is. I had to do and go through all of those experiences and have the pain that I did to get to where I'm at today. And I'm grateful for that. I wouldn't suggest you do that if you're new. I'll give the party line, get a sponsor, get into the steps, read the book with that sponsor. But that was just my experience. So.
Thank you. We're going to continue on page 60. Being convinced we were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood him. Just what do we mean by that? And just what do we do? The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as with most humans, he is likely to have varied traits. Heidi?
Hi again. Melissa did, that was awesome, man. You know, and she reminded me too, I forgot to tell you that, hi, I'm Heidi, I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 29th, 1997. My home group is Indian River 12-Step Study, which actually meets at Monday nights at 7 o'clock, so it's kind of hard to make both of these. But Kay is my sponsor, but since she just moved out of the area, I am courting a new sponsor right now. So I'm doing some cool little daily assignments with my new sponsor. Well, my potential new sponsor, when her sponsor said she could do it, because I guess she has 7 sponsees right now, so her sponsor said she's not supposed to take me on, so we're working on that right now. But okay, so back to the reading. You know, so some of what Melissa was talking about, you know, on paper, on the outside, I looked great. You know, my resume read beautifully. You know, on the inside, I had a black hole that was just sucking the life out of everything that I constantly tried to fill. I tried to fill it with success in school, success in work, with relationships, with one-night stands, with alcohol, with anything I could get my hands on to try to fill that void. And a lot of that ended up looking like this paragraph that it's talking about, like the, you know, director trying to run the show, because I wanted you to like me. I wanted you to think I was cool, I was smart, I was fill in the blank with any, you know, nice adjective that you're looking for kind of thing. You know, because if you liked me, then I would be okay. You know, and again, it's, you know, for a lot of women, it's pretty easy to find someone to like you temporarily for a night. You know what I mean? So that played a big part in my story. You know, because it's like, okay, if wow, yay, then I must be okay because, you know, someone's spending time with me. Woo! You know, but I did a lot of things to try to fill up that void. And that would roll over to all of my actions and my relationships with the people who were trying to stick around, like husband or, you know, friends or, you know, people. And if what they wanted from me or needed from me was not going to make me look good to other people who were anonymous, who I didn't know anyway, but I needed them to think that I looked good kind of thing, you know, I just squashed them. I mean, it really didn't matter what anyone else needed to me. You know, that was hard. You know, looking back on that, that was really hard. Because the people who were closest to me definitely got screwed over the most. You know, as far as the directing things, you know, I remember distinctly, you know, work. You know, I had a job in which there were lots of moving parts, you know, so there were at least 3 different levels of people before someone would, you know, before a patient would get to me and I get to do my job. And so, you know, if someone else, if I perceive they weren't doing it right, you know, I jump in and I try to do everybody else's job because you aren't doing it right. And if you're not doing it right, then the person's going to think that I don't know what I'm doing, which, of course, I was totally afraid that I really didn't know what I was doing. You know, so that insecurity and how dare you play on my insecurities and like confirm that I really don't know what I'm doing. So you have to make me look good. And if you're not doing your job right, then you're not making me look good. So how dare you? And oh my God, I've got to do your job. You know, I mean, like, my mind ran through crap like that all the time. So I think I was kind of definitely trying to run the show and direct everybody. And sometimes, you know, there would be wonderful results at the end of it, but usually not so much. And so, one of my first real aha moments, you know, after I had read the book with my sponsor and we had, you know, I had gone through the steps and I was working on the third step. And honestly, I mean, the first few years of doing the third step, I was totally faking it. I'm just like, okay, I will pretend to the best of my ability. I am turning it over. Sure. Go for it, God. Yeah, woo, team. You know, kind of thing. Like, I don't know that that was really happening, but I was trying. And, you know, I heard fake it till you make it, you know, from different people, and I'm like, okay, that's gonna have to do for right now. You know, I think it really was the best that I could do at the time, but I remember really distinctly one day being so stressed at work, and being like, God, this sucks. Or, sorry, this is not really cool. You know, and thinking, okay, let me turn this over. Let me try to get out of the way and see what, you know, the spirit of the universe has in store. So if I step out and I don't try to do everybody else's job, let's kind of see how that goes. And oh my gosh, the workday went so well. It was smooth. Everybody seemed happy. It was more efficient. And I'm like, wow, this is kind of interesting. Huh, maybe I should be trying this more often kind of thing. You know, so it's really cool how things happen. You know, I also started to realize that when I'm practicing turning it over more and more, that I see the neon signs that are out there. You know, in a sense, it's kind of like, you know, it got to the point where I could tell if I was trying to force my will on something, like it's like, oh, I think it should be done this way, or I think the outcome should be X. And then I'm trying to make everything make the outcome be X. You know, the more I practice turning it over, the more I'd realize when I'm running into that brick wall. And if I'd be trying to make something happen, you know, and I ran into the brick wall a couple times, I'd be like, oh, maybe this is one of those times where I'm making this all about me. And maybe I need to say third step prayer, thy will not mine be done, and step back. And then, boom! You know, all of a sudden an intuitive thought or, you know, an answer or inspiration would come. It's just like, wow, what a concept, what a cool trip. You know, so it's been fun putting this into practice. And, you know, so that early on I faked it. Now it's become, you know, such a part of my existence. I mean, really turning it over has become such a part of how my day goes. Every morning I start off with the third step prayer and I do a couple other prayers, you know, and I've really, you know, I've drunk the Kool-Aid at this point and kind of bought into the concept that, you know, my primary purpose is to be of maximum service to God and those around me. And the only way I can do that is by stepping out of the way and letting my higher power work through me. You know, I get to be the hands and feet of spirit, as do we all, you know, and it's pretty cool to be on that pathway.
Exciting. Man, we do have a lot in common. I was probably almost 2 years sober before I quit checking the box with step three and actually admitted that I had no higher power and hadn't really cared to have one, and was still holding on to a lot of control, but I'll talk more about that later. The first paragraph David read, being convinced, so that's basically, you know, reiterating the ABCs, being convinced that I'm an alcoholic. You know, my experience had showed me, and I'd listened enough to you guys telling me and read enough of this book that I was convinced I was an alcoholic, and that two, I or a medical professional or a family member, a friend, no human was going to be able to keep me from drinking again. I'd proven that to myself. I'd done that research. I'm hard-headed and stubborn, so one time isn't going to convince me. Like, I had to have multiple experiences to tell me that that was the case. And it continues, you know, decided to turn our will in our life. What does that mean? So my sponsor broke it down, and she said, your will is your thoughts and your life are your actions. So willing to turn my thoughts and my actions over. Okay, that's layman's terms. I can get behind that. You know, over to God as I understand him. That stopped me. I didn't stop working the steps. I just kept, you know, plowing through, just kept doing the actions. But, you know, I was not, I was just lost. I was raised Catholic. I don't hate God. I didn't love God. I didn't, God was just neutral to me. Hadn't really done anything for me in my delusional mind. Hadn't really done anything to me either. But it's, God wasn't a part of my life. Wasn't something I made a priority or hadn't since I was, you know, like 16 years old when I stopped going to church. And that was really important for me too, coming in here. You know, the misconceptions that this is a religious program. This has nothing to do with religion. This is completely a spiritual program. You don't have to have anybody's conception of God but your own. In fact, it was at that two-year point where my first sponsor, she was getting a little frustrated with me, and she knew I'd been faking it the whole time. So she took me to the ARE at the oceanfront. And she was like, here, this is the second largest metaphysical library in the world. You like to read. Find a higher power. And I was like, what? That is crazy. Like, that's going to take me forever. She's like, that's how complicated you're making this. And I was like, okay, let me shrink under the table now. And she was right. You know, that's another one of those, I'm right. I know what's right. No, it took that smack in the face, essentially, to make it that simple and dumb it down for me that much, for it to click with me. And from that point forward, it got a whole lot easier to develop a concept of a higher power, who I do choose to call God today. You know, my concept of a higher power is kind of a combination of my two grandfathers. You know, they both passed away about 10 years ago, and both just amazing people, and that's just what I see. You can see, anyone can see whomever they want, he, she, it, you know, whatever. My God is someone that is just like my granddad's. I can go and have a conversation with. I'm not afraid. We can talk. They're, you know, my higher power is loving, kind, tolerant, patient. We just have conversations. For me, that's what I need. I don't need a, you know, that concept of a God-fearing higher power like that. Just, that doesn't work for me. I butt up against that pretty hard. And then, you know, the rest of this paragraph's talking about the director and making the arrangements. I don't know if anybody else is like this, but even when I did this and everything went the way I wanted it to, it still wasn't good enough. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't right. It was never going to be good enough because I'm never satisfied. When I get to the goal, or the point that I think I'm at where I want to be, that's what I wanted out of this situation, I'm not happy. Because I'm constantly seeking other things to fill this hole in myself other than what I found today, God. That's the only thing that can fill me up and make me happy and satisfied and content. That's all that has been able to work for me, and it's taken a lot of time to come to that realization. And, you know, I'll lose sight of that very easily when things are going great. Melissa takes her control back, her will back, and I got this. And then things quickly start to go back in the other direction, and it's nothing huge. It's nothing, you know, I didn't go out and, you know, wreck a car or quit a job or do something like that. But it's, for me today, like, it's very easy to recognize. And the other part that's great is I choose to let people in today, and they recognize it, and they recognize it swiftly. And I have, you know, a very, very strong line of women in my sponsorship family, and we call each other out in an instant on our crap, which before I would have been like, who do you think you are telling me about myself? And today I crave that. I might get mad in the first 3 seconds because, you know, let's face it, that's just how I am. And in the next breath, it's like, thank you so much. I'm really glad you said that. I really appreciate you being honest with me. Because for the longest time, I was never honest with myself. And that is something that this program has taught me. If I'm not honest with myself, I'm not going to be honest with you. And I'm never going to, it's just that vicious circle of suck, which my life was before I came into this program and started actually working this program.
Awesome. All right, we're going to continue on page 61. I think I'm going to read 2 paragraphs. What usually happens? The show doesn't come off very well. He begins to think life doesn't treat him right. He decides to exert himself more. He becomes, on the next occasion, still more demanding, or gracious, as the case may be. Still, the play does not suit him. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, he is sure other people are more to blame. He becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. What is his basic trouble? Is he not a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? Is it not evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things he wants? And do not his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Is he not, even in his best moments, a producer of confusion rather than harmony? And then we'll go on page 62. This is the hard part. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them, even though we would have liked to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help.
Gosh, this is all such good stuff. So I'm going to go to the delusion that we can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of the world if we only manage well. When I was going through the book with one of my sponsors, because I've had different sponsors throughout the years. We did the whole you have to look up the words kind of thing. So to rest, to gain with difficulty by, or as if by force, violence, or determined labor. I'm just like, oh, I tried to wrest lots of happiness out of things. It's just like a struggle, a throwdown. I'm going to make this happen. If it kills me or you, I really don't care. We're going to be happy, darn it. And just like Melissa was saying to me, I was never satisfied. Never. It didn't matter what the end result was or what the accomplishment was or you reached the peak of the mountain. It was never enough. So no matter how hard I worked at it or how much I struggled or how much I tried to force it to happen, the show never went like my mind thought it should. And that black hole within me continued to grow, And like was also said, I really love all your shares. This is awesome. I'd sit and listen to you all hour. It was only through working the steps and working this program that slowly but surely, that black hole went away. And it didn't happen overnight for me. It was one of those things like months after having worked through the steps, completely worked through the steps and, going to meetings almost every day at that point. All of a sudden I woke up one day and I realized I was at peace and that hole was gone. It's just like, ooh, what a concept. Switching gears to the You know, neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. You know, I was trying to take notes on this stuff, you know, because I'm an overachiever and I want to make sure it works well, you know. But I also now, you know, I sat in my car before the meeting and did a little prayer and said, okay, God's will, not mine, be done. Okay, higher power, you know, let me be a conduit. But I still like notes, you know, right? That's part of the preparation. You know, I'm like, my self-will cannot will my self-will away, right? You know, I mean, like, I can't teach myself how to do something that I don't know how to do, one. And, you know, I can try to wrest, you know, the solution out of it, you know, but this is beyond human help. You know, it has to be something outside of me. You know, and again, as I mentioned, you know, I grew up with really cool hippy-dippy parents, you know, so I didn't have a specific religious upbringing that I came from, you know, so I didn't have anything I needed to rebel against, you know. I had spent a lot of time while I was drinking, you know, debating. If you took the side that God existed, I'd go with a God doesn't exist. If you took the side that God doesn't exist, I'd go with a God exists, because, I mean, why not, right? I mean, let's just have a party and debate life, you know? And so I did a lot of that, you know, and realized that didn't bring me any closer to any kind of spiritual revelations, you know? But I've come over the years for myself. I have the spirit of the universe. Couldn't draw you a picture of it. Couldn't tell you exactly how it works. But it's mine and it works for me, right? You know, I've run into a lot of people who have challenges with the concept of something bigger. And I've kind of come to the belief that it doesn't matter what you call it, what it looks like, what qualities it has, as long as you're cool with it. And it's not you, you know, it's got to be something bigger than me, something outside of me. And I found for myself, that's been a journey. The evolution of my higher power has been a journey, you know, and it's gone through a multitude of different phases, you know, but the key that I was taught was it couldn't be me. Because I'd spent the majority of my drinking, or actually the majority of my life and all my drinking days being like, I've got this, you know, I can make this happen, you know. And I had never been successful with stopping drinking, you know. I tried, I'd white-knuckled it once for 9 months, you know, at the threat of my husband leaving. Kind of thing, and you know, so I did it for 9 months, and you know, that was torture, and it was horrible, and life sucked, man. You know, so the first chance I got, you know, when I was given permission, you know, so I'm sure you can have a glass of wine. I'm just okay then, woo, back to the races, you know. But I couldn't do this by myself. I was going to go somewhere else with, oh, I know it. Okay, so the whole self-centeredness thing, you know, so the first husband that was with me when I was drinking, finally after a year of me being sober, you know, decided he didn't need to be codependent anymore, and he specifically told me, I don't think you're going to self-destruct anymore, so I'm going to go find myself, and I can't do it with you by my side, bye. And I'm like, what the, wow, that was weird, because I started off getting sober for him. Good thing by that point I was being sober for me and being in recovery for me. But when I married my second husband, he's one of those guys who, like, maybe in a year drinks like 3 beers. Like, he does not know what it is to drink, you know. And we wrote our own vows. And, you know, the St. Francis prayer, that it's better to love than to be loved, better to understand than to be understood, better to comfort than to be comforted. He actually wrote that into his vows to me. And I remember when he was saying that, I'm like, wow, dude. I'm like, oh my God, I think he really means it. Like, and I thought, I'm like, I could not say that back to you. I mean, I didn't tell him that, right? But I mean, like, you know, and I was sober for a while at that point. But I mean, like, I just was way still too into me. Like, it's about me, right? I mean, didn't matter that I'd been sober for a while and in recovery for a while and had been through the steps a few times, but still it was about me, you know? I mean, I'm a work in progress, what can I say? You know, but I distinctly remember, like, around our 7th year anniversary, I was doing the whole, like, okay, what do I get for our anniversary, you know? And I went by one of those engraving stores, and they actually had part of the St. Francis prayer engraved on something. And I looked down, like, oh my God, I could actually say it and mean it. This is so cool. Now, we had been married 7 years, I'd been sober for a while, you know, but like, I was so excited that I could say that I had it engraved, you know, and gave him, because I was just like, yes, finally, I'm getting better. So anyway, I'll stop at that.
Exciting. So I talked a little about some of this in the last reading too. The part that really hits home is talking about trying harder and then the delusion. So my entire life before I got sober was a delusion. My sponsor, when I started working with her, she sat me down and she asked me a question. She said, "Who are you?" And that was my reaction. Deer in the headlights, English lit major, you know, I have no words. I couldn't tell you. She said, "That's okay." She said, "By the time we get through the steps and by the time we get, you know, some of this work under our belt, you're going to be able to start answering that question. You're never going to be able to fully answer that question, but you're going to be able to start answering that question." Mm-hmm. And she's been right. Like, I can give it a fair run now, answering that question. And, you know, I was the type of person that would do and say whatever you wanted so that you would like me and you would keep me around, because that would fulfill whatever I thought I was trying to fill. It would help those fears lessen a little bit. I was a chameleon. You know, I could fit in anywhere with anybody. I would do and say anything, and that was just me. And it wasn't, I didn't think I was doing it out of, you know, bad intentions. It was just my armor. It's how I was surviving until I found alcohol. And then depending on how drunk I was, it either I didn't give a shit anymore and I would just speak my mind, which I was usually in a blackout, so I would find out the next day via text message what I'd said. Or I would not black out and be fully aware and not drunk enough. I got to the point in my drinking that I couldn't put enough booze in my body to make anything stop, to make my mind shut up, to make any of those thoughts and feelings go away. And that's when I knew I was screwed. And that's not the point that I stopped drinking. Mm-hmm. That's the point that I think I knew I had a problem, but I was still convinced that I could do something about it. You know, like I said, it took me a while. I didn't drink really for that long, maybe 8 or 9 years. But when it hit me, and it hit me hard. But so that's that paragraph. And then, yeah, the selfishness and self-centeredness, 100%. I am still selfish and self-centered, and I will always be selfish and self-centered. And the quicker I admitted that and accepted that, it makes life a whole lot easier to work through those things. And another thing that on that last paragraph I wanted to say too, you know, the last line, is he not even in his best moments a producer of confusion rather than harmony? And I have a note that says expectations without communication. And that was huge for me. I would expect you to react a certain way, and when you didn't, and I would get pissed, but I wouldn't tell you why I was upset. And I still do that. I'm better at it than I used to be, but I will you know, I'm single, so I'm trying to date. And before I even go on a first date with someone, I've already played out the tape like a year down the line to our first fight, me meeting your parents, blah, blah, blah. And like, I haven't even met this person. I haven't even spent any time with them. I'm a work in progress for sure, just like Heidi is. But, you know, that word expectations has come to mean so much to me in my recovery. It was a little over a year sober in a meeting on Christmas Day, and I heard someone say, expectations are resentments under construction. Mm-hmm. And, you know, step four is all about resentments, and, you know, get into that next week. But when I remember that, and I don't go into situations with as big of expectations, because let's be honest, I'm going to have some sort of expectation, period, about every situation. Things go a lot smoother when I have like expectations shooting the moon. I'm always disappointed. I will always be disappointed in some form or fashion. And that's not fair to that other person. You know, they have no clue, honestly, that I'm crazy, usually. One, and two, like, they're just living their life. And I'm just trying to live mine, but, you know, that's part of me wanting to constantly be in control of every aspect of my life. And step three teaches me that, guess what, honey, you're not really in control of any of it. You may think you are, you may think that you're making these decisions based on whatever, but there's some guidance that has to come into play there for me. In order for things to go a little bit more smoothly than they have in the past. And thankfully, they do go more smoothly than they did in the past, because I've ceased to be totally self-reliant, and I'm more God-reliant today. So.
All right. This is my favorite paragraph in the big book on page 62. This is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Next, we decided that hereafter, in this drama of life, he was going to be our director. He is the principal. We are his agents. He is the father. We are his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we passed to freedom.
Woohoo! Okay, let's go. Freedom, yeah, rock on. So I am going to go with it, you know. So it says it's simple, so of course I'm not going to make it simple. I mean, like, why would I do that? That just, you know, goes against all my nature. But actually, I'm just, again, going to share something that my sponsor shared with me as we were going through this, because I just, you know, there are little things that, you know, have themes throughout the book that I just think are really cool. So, you know, I was taught that, you know, we are, and this is on page 47, there's a part that talks about we're building a wonderfully effective spiritual structure. And I was taught that in step one, we're given the cement. You know, we're given the initial materials to build this. So we've got our common peril and our common situation. You know, we're all alcoholics and we're all looking to do something about it. So we've got our cement. In step two, around page 47, you've got the cornerstone. You know, we're finding that we've got a higher power. There's something that's got our back, right? And I was taught that the cornerstone is the first block that's set kind of in a building, and it's something that's essential that you have to have, you know, to get it started. And then here, what was just read, you know, this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we passed to freedom. You know, step three is that keystone, you know, that God's in charge or a higher power's in charge. It's not me in charge. And I was taught that keystone, it's, you know, when you're building an arch, that keystone is that top one that kind of holds the sides together. Without it, everything falls apart. You know, and for some reason, my brain, it seemed like a cool puzzle to me. So it's just like, ooh, I like that. So when the keystone came up, I'm like, oh, I want to share. You know, yeah. Again, I think, you know, we've been kind of sharing tonight already. You know, I realize when I'm in, when I think I am in charge of everything, you know, my life is not as fulfilling. You know, and early on, early in sobriety, it's just like, okay, I'm running the show and I'm making everything happen, and wow, I can't stop drinking, and I keep crossing those lines. I mean, for me, really, I hit my bottom when I crossed more lines. I draw the line in the sand and I kept crossing it. And I, you know, hit that proverbial point where I could not, literally, I could not look myself in the mirror. You know, I felt like the scum of the earth. I felt like the worst human being. I felt like something had to be wrong with me, like psychotically, because I felt like I couldn't form true human relationships and really care about another person, because I seriously screwed over anyone who's close to me. And that's where my bottom came from. You know, and so when I was taught by a lot of loving people, you know, I had a couple sponsors that first year. You know, when I was taught that, hey, it's okay, you know, not only can't you do it yourself and be the one in charge, you know, when you turn it over, amazing things can happen. You know, and again, that black hole going away, you know, the idea that, you know, most of the time now, I have a sense of peace and calm. You know, now I have the true belief in every cell of my body that no matter what happens, it's going to be okay. No, that used to be in my head. I used to have to be like, okay, you know, okay, if I'm really doing this right, things are going to be cool, sure, fine. You know, and then over time, you know, continuing to practice these steps, you know, continuing to turn it over, that kind of moved from my head to my heart. And then continuing to do it more and more, it moved from my heart to literally like every cell in my body. So now it's like literally no matter what happens, and you know, I've been through divorce, I've been through death of people, I've been through suicide of family members, you know, no matter what happens, it's going to be okay. I don't know what exactly okay is going to look like, and I may not enjoy it at the time, but even that's okay. You know, and so turning it over and letting God do it's pretty awesome.
Yes, ditto. you know, this took me, like I've said, it took me a very, very long time to, one, not only get this, and to, two, believe it. Mm-hmm. You know, having faith has been a struggle and a challenge for me most of my life. And, you know, here you're asking me to turn over literally my life to this thing out there. And it's much, much easier, much simpler today because I actually have a concept of what that is. But it was scary. It was so scary at first. And, you know, I am not the type of alcoholic that has the burning bush moments, so I thought. That was not my experience in my first few years. Usually if I had a spiritual experience, my sponsor or someone close to me had to point it out to me and explain that that's what I had, because I was still not, it wasn't clicking. I wasn't ready to accept that that's what that was. Like, no, maybe that was still, you know, I had a little hand in that. And it's like, no, that wasn't what that was. But, you know, it's the more I continue to practice and turn this over, the simpler, it's just that word, simpler things get. And, you know, one of the biggest things in my life that I held control over in sobriety, and I've talked about it a little bit, is my job. You know, this January, I was coming up on 18 years with my company, and I was notified my position had been eliminated. And this wasn't the first time this had happened to me in sobriety. This had happened to me about 2.5 years into sobriety, and I freaked out. It was the end of the world. You know, what was I going to do? Financial insecurity has always been huge for me. And I, you know, jumped headfirst into, I'm making these decisions. I'm going to do. I've got to. And, you know, it turned out okay in that I got a promotion instead of getting laid off. And then I was miserable. Absolutely miserable. And, you know, the people around me loved me enough to not point that out, that I'd probably been miserable for the entire time they'd known me, which was the length of my sobriety. And you know, they gently suggest, maybe you should try something different. I'm like, I can't. I, you know, my pride and my ego would not allow me to let go of that. My whole status was wrapped up in this job. Like, I have to do this. This is what I have to do. And it wasn't what I had to do. And it took literally sitting on a forklift in the middle of a rainstorm, having a meltdown, for me to realize maybe I need to try something different. And I did. And that's what landed me into this position that was then eliminated this January. And, you know, I would like to say, like, I was like, oh my gosh, you know, what am I going to do? Like, I literally sat in this room with my 12 other colleagues that were also being let go. And I knew, like, what was going to happen. We got a forewarning email 2 days before. And since I'd been through this once before, I, you know, had an inkling of what was going to happen. And I didn't freak out then. And I still wasn't freaked out sitting in there in this room on this conference call. And I literally just had this complete moment of peace and just this calm washed from the top of my head through my toes and out of me. And I just leaned back in my chair and just sat there. And, you know, I see all the reactions around the room. There's anger, there's fear, there's crying, there's, you know, everything. And my boss is looking at me, and I see him out of the corner of my eye, and he's looking at me. He's not looking at anybody else because they're having all these natural human reactions. And I'm just sitting there like, and he's like, are you okay? And I was like, yeah, I'm fine. And I meant it. Mm-hmm. And it was the truth, because I knew it didn't matter what happened. God had it. Mm-hmm. I had finally, you know, turned that part of my life over. And, you know, they gave us 6 weeks to work out our projects. And I did not prepare a resume. I did not apply for a single job. My plan was to take off like 3 months and just chill, because I got a decent severance. And then I was going to go get my real estate license. And my last day at that job, someone that I had done some work for had me come meet someone that she worked with, and he offered me a part-time position. And after a month of working for that guy, he made me full-time. And it's a Monday through Friday job. I worked in retail. I worked any day of the week, any hours of the day. And, you know, I work 7:30 to 3:30 and can have a consistent schedule and can make meetings consistently and, you know, be present when I need to be present for my family. I just got back from 10 days in Europe. Like, that doesn't, I didn't have anything to do with that. You know, that has all happened because I finally ceased fighting and let go and finally just turned some stuff over and been like, you know what, I'm done. I don't have the energy for this anymore. You take control and let's see what happens. And I can tell you, I've yet to be disappointed with any of the results. You know, the path to get there isn't always painless. And that's usually because of me. It's usually nothing to do with anything my higher power has in store for me. It's me kicking and fighting and screaming the entire way. So that's all I got.
Oh, hey, we're out of time.
Oh.
We'll let Bill Wilson have the last word, page 63. We were now at step three. Many of us said to our Maker as we understood him, God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me, and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I might better do thy will. Take away my difficulties. I like that part. That victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of your power, your love, and your way of life. May I do thy will always. We thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. We are going to pass the seventh tradition basket. We have no dues or fees in AA, but here's where we put them. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Although the amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world, we may want to remember that a dollar does not support as many services as it used to. Are there any announcements for the good of AA? Quick and loud. All right. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members. Newcomers, you're the reason we're here tonight. Is there anyone in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you by first name.
Hi, my name is Rodney.
Hey, Rodney.
Hey, welcome. Glad you're here.
Literature is available behind me. Please see any home group member after the meeting. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information on sponsorship, I will be available at this table after we close the meeting. Please feel free to talk to me. Smokers, please use the butt cam provided outside and stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. May we thank the panel one more time. After we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the step discussed tonight at the meeting after the meeting, which will be held at Plaza del Sol, a little boutique Mexican place at the corner of 22nd and Colonial. And Aaliyah, would you read the last two paragraphs on page 164, please?
Yes, sir. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find, and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you for a great meeting. Let's circle up.
Let's go in front of the people.
Okay.
Yes, definitely.